Random Radio.
So, hi, welcome to Talking Anthropology. I just came back from hibernation to do this great interview with Gabriela Coleman, who is sitting right in front of me. I've been waiting to do this interview for, I think, around a year now, and so I'm very, very happy, actually, to do it. And to introduce my guest, Gabriela Coleman is assistant professor at the New York University Steinhardt, and she is one of the few anthropologists whose work also are very well known in the digital field. She did field work and published in the realms of free and open source cultures, hackers, and anonymous, especially protesting the Church of Scientology. And yeah, welcome to have you on the show, Gabriela.
Thanks for having me. Sorry for making you wait so long.
No problem. Actually, it's much better to do this live and in this circumstances than over Skype.
I completely agree. I knew that we'd have an opportunity sometime later.
Yeah, first start with the obvious. Why are you here at Chaos Communication Camp?
Well, I think I'm here in part because it is such a legendary event, which I've actually never been to. I've been to some of the Dutch camps in the past. And I really think that when it comes to understanding what hacking is, why it's important, and what the community is like, there's nothing better than going to a great hacker conference. And it really does seem like the Computer Chaos Club camps really take the cake in that regard. It's really amazing and everything I expected.
I think what sets you apart from most other anthropologists engaging in this field, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that you have a very high degree of media literacy when it comes to the hacker community, and you are also actually actively engaging in it sometime, I think. I mean, you are participating in events like this, and you've done research before about other hacker conferences, especially in Debian culture. And maybe just start with this. So maybe let's start from the beginning. What were your first footsteps in internet and anthropology? Where does this interest of yours come from?
Sure. Well, let me start a little bit with anthropology, which really did not relate to hackers very quickly, and then I'll talk about how I got into the field of hackers, which came much later. But I was exposed to anthropology when I was 16, actually, when our history teacher in high school revealed to us that she had studied anthropology in college. And we were all like, ooh, what's anthropology? And we asked her to teach us an introductory class. And that is exactly what happened. And it was one of the few times where I kind of knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to become an anthropologist. And lo and behold, many years later, that's exactly what I did. And the reason why I was compelled by anthropology was that it was a field that helped us understand our own values and the differences and conflicts over values, whether that is about labor or gender within our own society, and often doing so through cross-cultural comparison. I was very much interested in traditional anthropology. I probably wanted to work in New Guinea or Latin America with a kind of a small-scale society, and that was the path I was on when I went to graduate school. And then due to a prior interest on patents and medicine, I've always found it a little bit problematic that patents are applied to medicine. There's a place for it, but I think it can cause a lot of problems. Some of my friends who are programmers pulled me aside and said, well, if you have some problems with the patent system, then you might want to learn about free software. And you might, in specific, want to learn about the copyleft, which is the alternative license to the copyright. And basically, they sat me down and explained the world to free software to me, and I was completely blown away for many different reasons, which we could maybe talk about later. And to me, this seemed really exciting because there was a way in which these computer hackers who had a problem with the legal system didn't wait to have the system changed. They didn't necessarily use the courts. They hacked the law and created their own system that then was being used by all sorts of hackers and then eventually others. And to me, this was fascinating, and I wanted to understand it more and more. And it happened during a period of time where I got a fast internet connection at home. Next thing you know, I'm just spending all my time online reading about it. This was back in 97. And I knew if I wanted to finish my anthropology degree, I would just have to switch over to this domain. So that's how it happened.
Okay, maybe we can go a few steps further into your findings when it comes to this open source licenses you research, and also the specific usage culture that evolved out of it. I remember your text, and you were always pointing out a high degree of maybe legal expertise these communities developed over time, and how they negotiated many things, also many classical cultural things, over these legal battles they fought, also in a day-to-day basis when it came for the question of accepting or rejecting a certain software package.
Absolutely. So one of the things that interested me once I started to learn more and more about different free software communities is how even with developers or hackers who may not be motivated by anything but kind of utilitarian motivations, I just want better software, they're not interested in the politics or ethics. Even those computer hackers and developers nonetheless had an incredibly sophisticated command of the law. And what was clear was that the site of free and open source software was not simply about the creation of technology. It was not simply about the creation of institutions or projects that can help coordinate the development of software, but it was also a place where many developers in different levels got to learn about the law. And of course, there is a lot of differences between the law and hacking and code, but there's also a lot of similarities as well. They're both very kind of formal, logical systems that require a lot of precision especially at the textual level, because we know the law in courts can get very, very messy and irrational, right? But just on the books, they're not. And there was a way in which I think free software became so powerful as not simply a techno-social movement, but also a legal movement, because of the ways that hackers so easily got to learn the law, both within their own domain, but also to question the law that was affecting their own practice. So that was one area that I spent a considerable amount of time researching and writing about.
You're at least not the only anthropologist on the camp here that I know of. And it seems to me that this interest, at least from some people in the discipline, grow into hacking open source culture. And I was wondering what you think is the specific kind of findings, the quality of the research that anthropology can offer, because it is distinct, in my opinion, from other subjects and sciences.
That's an important question to raise. What is it that anthropology might be offering, or might not as well? We can also talk about the limits of it. And why is it that there's a handful here? Is that even necessary? My answer is absolutely. First of all, one of the things about computer hacking is that while there may be a general spirit that permeates different types of hacking, hardware hacking, free software hacking, info security hacking, there is still such a deep history to it. And there's also just so much going on at one time that researchers really can be spending their time on very different facets to bring a certain type of understanding, right? It's really remarkable to me, even just the domain of free software, where I studied the Debian project very closely, and I was picking between FreeBSD and Debian, which to me were some of the most interesting Linux, Unix distributions, and yet culturally they were very different, the culture of FreeBSD and Debian. I picked Debian in part because they had such strong ethical considerations. So what do anthropologists possibly bring to the table? And how is their method perhaps slightly different than, let's just say, a sociologist? So I think one of the hallmarks of anthropology is that you really try to get a very holistic perspective of what you're looking at, where you don't just pay attention to what, let's just say, spokespeople or leaders say about a community. You're interested in everything from general practice to conflicts to certain historical moments or events that are particularly important to a community, to the larger sort of legal and social forces that enable or constrain a community. Which means that, for example, when you get a PhD in anthropology, it takes a really long time. The average number of years at University of Chicago was something ridiculous, like 10 or 11 years to get an anthropology degree. And that's in part because I think there's two reasons. One of which, you really try to throw yourself completely in a community, and it just takes a really long time to understand what's going on, to gain the trust of people, to really talk to everyone you can sort of talk to. I also think anthropologists become involved pretty closely in the communities that they study, and then they don't want to leave. So then they end up just staying a little bit longer, even when their research is done. And I know that happened to me. I was in San Francisco for over 3 years, and I probably could have left after two. And so that gets to the other element, which is the participation that happens with anthropology. And you are encouraged to participate to some degree, because the idea is that unless you experience part of the world that you're studying, you may not really understand them. And so then the question is, well, do you become, you know, do you go native? Do you lose your objectivity as a result? And the answer is yes and no. On the one hand, the participation gives you a vantage point by which to see something that you wouldn't see, but you also never can participate fully in the world you study, especially if you don't come from there. So in my case, I took some Python programming classes and Unix administration classes. I really got to know Debian. I helped organize one of their conferences. And yet, you know, they're still a kind of world apart from me, and that allows me to keep some degree of objectivity. I think in a nutshell, anthropology is a little bit of empathy towards the folks you're looking at and working with, part detective work of trying to figure out things that may not be obvious to anyone, and some level of participation as well.
Just go on.
Okay.
We have a background noise.
Yeah,
here, that's
someone
no
is beeping at us. Now, more than ever, we do look at worlds that have great sociological data about everything from, you know, the classical variables such as age and gender and education, which anthropologists tend to collect as well. But when you work in digital domains, there's all this like amazing data. So for example, on a mailing list, you can map out who's talking to who at what moment, when does conversation spike at what time. And so more than ever, anthropologists too are leaning on researchers who really look at large scale data sets as well. And I think that's important. We're at the rudimentary stages of that, but I really do hope to see that there's more collaborations between those who work with large data sets and then anthropologists who tend to work from a very kind of qualitative standpoint, using the individual as the instrument of data collection and understanding.
I think the digital dimension is one of the most important and very fastly growing ones in nearly all contexts globally, when it comes to how human life is influenced on a macro and micro level. And what do you think? I often have the feeling and the experience that anthropology is not really coping up with this battle. There is still a kind of tendency to lean towards classical, old-fashioned, maybe somehow romantic idea of isolation and abstraction from technology instead of engaging into the new possibilities which arise with these technologies. How do you see your own discipline when it comes to this digital turn?
So I'll start with a personal story, and I think your diagnosis is right, though there's change afoot. But when I went to my advisors and said, you know, there's this thing called Linux and the copyleft is also like fascinating, like there's so much to do here. And I could tell they were quite excited, but they also said, Biela, as I'm often called, you know, you're not going to get a job in an anthropology department if you do this project. You know, is that going to be a problem? And at the time I said, no, this is what I want to do. This is where my heart is. And they were correct. I ended up in a media studies department. And in fact, it was only once out of numbers of interviews where I was ever even interviewed in an anthropology department. And I think in part, the problem was not so much the tech part, but we'll talk about that. I think it's part of it, is that I didn't focus in on a traditional area of the world. I did not do free software in India. I did not do free software in Brazil. I did not do free software in the Philippines. And I think if I had done an area of the world, that would have counted as the culture. And technology would have been, you know, the add-on part. And in fact, I made a very conscious choice, extremely conscious choice, to study free software in European and North American societies. Because I didn't, first of all, as a young female anthropologist, I didn't want to be slotted as the anthropologist who looked at the minority, quote, minority issues, right? And I think the bias is totally off. I think that while obviously free software in Brazil is incredibly important, extremely fascinating, actually one of the most fascinating places when it comes to free software, hands down, they win. I do think that the question of culture in computer hacking in the West, in Europe, in America, is 120% cultural from top to bottom, turtles all the way down. You know, there's no denying it. And yet, I think that there is a bias that is not totally omnipresent, but there's a bias there where anthropologists tend to see computers, males, many of which are white, is not necessarily residing in the cultural domain. And I do think that is a problem and also a legacy that anthropology has dealt with and that will hopefully change in the coming decades.
I'll leave us the discussion of the culture term at this moment. But what are the tendencies you mentioned earlier that this might change soon?
I think the fact that a number of anthropologists have published some very respected studies, such as Chris Kelty, who is currently at UCLA, joint in the Anthro Department and Information Studies, along with a number of other researchers, have changed the game in some ways. It's just a matter, a little bit of education or opening up certain possibilities. I also think, as you pointed out, the digital has just reached into so many different areas of life, not necessarily in the ways that some kind of utopian language represents it, right? It's not necessarily always for the good, nor in ways that pundits will talk about, but it's undeniable that technology is present in so many different ways in societies and practices that now so many anthropologists actually do fascinating studies of the digital when they're not even wanting to do anything on the digital. So, for example, there's been some anthropological work done in Nigeria on corruption. Well, guess what comes up? Spam and the 419 email. And some of the best work on spam has come from these anthropologists who are not even out to do digital anthropology, but they stumble upon it. And so in that way, anthropology is just kind of forced to look at it as well. Recently, I was just asked to write a long article, an annual review of anthropology surveying digital media. It was the first time that one had been done since 2002, and I took that as a very positive sign as well.
Is it the ethnographic approaches to digital media?
That's the one.
Okay.
Hell, a complete hell to write, but I think does signal that people are interested in the topic.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that you yourself learned Python and got some degree of technical skills in for really engaging into this culture. And would you agree that somehow it is comparable? If you are an anthropologist studying a culture and you're not able to speak the language, it is similar if you are going into hacker or open source culture and you're not able to understand the principles of networking and the basic rudimentary principles of programming.
You absolutely need to understand the basics. You know, if you don't know what a compiler is or what a pointer is in a computer language, you're just not going to understand what the hell's going on during conversation.
Not even the jokes.
Right. Not even the jokes. And the jokes are incredibly important, right? But there is, I have to say, one of the things, for example, you said, I learned Python. I hope no one comes up to me and like, hey, you want a job as a Python programmer? Because I'd be like, no, I'm like terrible at it. Because there is also a fact in the hacker world is that there's experts in these domains. Now, a hacker tends, with a few exceptions, not to be an expert in, you know, 20 languages and system administration and security researchers, because that's one of the fascinating things about what I call the pragmatics of hacking, is that on the one hand, individuals are so well-versed in a few areas of expertise, but because of the nature of computers, you must always rely on others as well for help, too. And I just love to see that dynamic unfold where people are obviously so smart. They've bootstrapped themselves. They've learned a lot on their own. And yet when it comes down to it, you have to ask others for help. Now, as an anthropologist, what you do need to do is really understand enough so that you could follow conversations, so that you can ask questions, so you could understand where the ethical and aesthetic issues lie. And it is always tricky in terms of how much is enough. And in part, it depends on the questions you're asking and what you're trying to do with your research. But at some level, it is absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. I'm quite sure that you know about the history of hackers, and there is a very, very big tradition which is also open source in a way, because you can read up about nearly every historical event which is of any significance in this scene. And so I wonder if this is also a difference to other research projects, because somehow everything is digital, so everything is there to be repeated and universally copied, and the access to this culture is quite easy.
So Chris Kelty, who's this great anthropologist and a great mentor to me, described what you're talking about as archival hubris. Like, geeks and hackers don't simply have cultural worlds, but they're documenting it always at the same time, you know? And that means, as a researcher, part of the problem is not simply the problem sometimes is too much information that is just available with a Google search, or with someone who's like, hey, I've got IRC logs from this 5-year period. Do you want them? You're like, what do I do with 5 years worth of IRC logs, right? But that's kind of the weirdness as well, is that on the one hand, you're absolutely right. There is just this archive, this information, and yet is also one of the most misunderstood or poorly understood or just not understood cultural worlds. And why that is complicated. There's a number of things going on, but one of which is clearly people do need to filter that data, because in its unfiltered form, it just sits as information and hasn't been processed as knowledge to outsiders. Now, when you're within those worlds, obviously, because maybe you've read this stuff or there's a lot of lore and stories, it's known, but in a different way than the outside world may know it. But it definitely changes the dynamics of research. And I sometimes think, wow, if I ever switched to a domain where I couldn't so easily find information, I'd be kind of screwed. Because I've gotten kind of, you know, slightly lazy, knowing that I could always look up that mailing list conversation and, in fact, jump on internet relay chat and go, hey, guys, remember that conversation about that licensing debate from 2007? Can you help me find it? Or, you know, I go in and post the mailing list thread and start asking some questions about it. It's something that is very unusual when it comes to research.
How is the general reaction on your research interest and also maybe your findings from this free and open source scene? To stick with that for the moment.
Sure. I mean, one of the things about an academic is that a lot of our work is really boring to read. So I don't think that gobs of people are reading it, but there definitely has been quite a number of Debian developers who have read, especially about the Debian work I've published or put out there. And reception has been so far, at least to my face or to my email account, very positive. You know, who knows what people say in the back channels. But one of the interesting reactions was that I got quite a bit was a little bit like, I didn't expect you to say anything I didn't know already. And one can say, wow, that's a really egotistical comment. But I think it's actually because hackers and developers are very self-aware of the communities that they build, of their practices, right? So, of course, like, it isn't surprising. And it's hard to come in there and say, I have something else to say. And the only reason that I do have some other things to say, and much of what I say should strike as very familiar to hackers, and it's something that would probably not surprise them at all, is just because you just spend a lot of time thinking about social dynamics, you know, for years and years, and you have a lot of literature at your disposal by which to bring some interesting coherence. But you're also kind of filtering 10 years of social dynamics and knowledge and institution building to one chapter to tell an interesting story. And that's one reason why you can come in there and say something interesting and important. I also often will pull some people before I publish something and have them read it to give me comments as well. I very much see people I work with as, you know, not informants, which kind of says, you're somewhat at a different status than me, but more interlocutors, kind of peers and colleagues. And just like with my colleagues, sometimes I have something more to offer, sometimes they have something more to offer. It's very kind of similar dynamic at play.
And I think generally the people you were writing about would like to read your final words and your final papers when they are published. And is it a licensing issue sometimes for you if you want to get something printed and at the same time you want it under free license so that you don't make enemies with right. your research partners?
So on my department webpage, people will notice most articles are under a copyright, but available on my webpage because most journals allow you to post a version on your institutional webpage. And there was a very difficult battle to fight because I need those publications for tenure. But there was one place I was willing to fight, and I thought it was the most important fight to engage in, and that had to do with a book that I'm publishing, which will hopefully be out in about a year. That means I'll be turning it in just a couple of weeks. And I felt that was incredibly important to not have a copyright on that because it was a book on free software and that there was a real contradiction publishing that as a copyrighted book. And so I went to my publisher and explained this contradiction, this problem. And at first, you know, it was a little resistant only because the publisher had never released a book under a Creative Commons license. And then I said something along the lines of, well, publishing a book on free software with a copyright is like publishing a Hindu prayer book on leather. You know, it's really a problem. And he got it and said, all right, let's move forward with trying to come up with an alternative license. And so we have a kind of restrictive Creative Commons license. And yet it is one where people will be able to freely download and share the book once it's out. And I'm very happy about that. And then I do hope in the future to push more and more for open access and publishing. I think it's essential to do that, especially when so much of our funding as researcher comes from either governmental grants or nonprofits as well. So I really do believe in that, but and things have changed. It's much easier today than just 5 years ago.
I think a discussion about journals in social science would be a totally different show, which would be very important, but we can't do now because we are already half our time is left. Is the working title of your book still Hacking in Person?
It's Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Pleasure of Hacking.
Okay. Maybe we come into hacking and anonymous because you became quite famous with your research of anonymous, starting with their protest 2008 against the Church of Scientology, and I think you've been following anonymous some way over the years since then, and maybe you can also give us the introduction. Why did it happen that you start getting interested in Anonymous?
Okay, that is truly not a short story, but I'm going to make it short. During my research on free software, the Church of Scientology came up with a remarkable degree of frequency. People are just like, I don't like the church, or I protested the church. But I filed this away because as anthropologists, we come up or we're exposed to all sorts of data that may not be relevant to our project. I didn't really know what to make of it. And then I went to University of Alberta in 2008, where there's the largest Scientology archives in the world. And I was like, someone, you know, God, Xenu, someone is sending me a sign to like delve into this issue of why some geeks and hackers have been interested in the church, especially been interested in protesting the church. And so I started on a project that looked at the battles through the 1990s, that unfolded on Usenet, among other places, after critics of the church were heavily punished through legal and illegal means by the Church of Scientology. And I found this domain very exciting to study as an anthropologist, because one of the things that I started to make some arguments about is that the Church of Scientology is a kind of perfect nemesis because it represents a total inversion of the things that geeks and hackers value. So if you had something like a cultural inversion machine and you stuck computer hacking in there, you'd get something that looked like Scientology, in part because it's a religion of, you know, quote unquote science and technology, yet it's technology that doesn't work. It's a very proprietary kind of organization. The question of science fiction comes up both in hacking and the church. But ironically, I was actually very afraid to talk about my research in public. I was secretive about my research because the Church of Scientology went after journalists and researchers. So I'd make up titles that were wrong when I gave talks about it. And it was purely a project that was historical. And then in 2008, something by the name Anonymous emerged from the internets, from 4chan, and started to raid and troll and hack the Church of Scientology. And then this entity by the name of Anonymous went from just pranking the church into a protest movement. And because I'd already worked on this topic of kind of geeks and hackers and internet enthusiasts against the church, I said, oh, this is a perfect place to go. And I just followed the rabbit as it went down the hole. And then I've since discovered that the hole is very deep and there's many rabbits, in fact, when it comes to Anonymous. And especially as they changed over the years, I just had invested too much time following them to turn away.
Security hacking groups is a huge topic, which also goes back way beyond Anonymous. And I mean, recently, after 2008, AntiSec, LulzSec, Telecomics, there are many quite different of these entities emerging, and they get a lot of media attention because they, some could argue, do a lot of damage or do a lot of good. However you see it, they are of relevance. And do you have any findings on that, or will it be part of the book?
It's definitely part of my second book project, which is looking at groups like Anonymous and Telecomics and hopefully contextualizing them within a much, much longer history. There was a big anti-sec movement on FNET back in the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, that forms a really important prehistory. There's also prehistory of the denial of service attack as protests and all sorts of things. You know, in terms of findings or what I'm concentrating on, it's a couple of different things. Within Anonymous, I'm very interested in their anti-leader, anti-individualism, anti-celebrity ethic. I think that's very unusual in this day and age, where all social media encourages us to be very public as to who we are. So that's one line of analysis that is central. I think that the question of the lulls and the both playful and more frightening aspects of it fascinate me, because as a political tactic, I see it as something that is central to the identity of Anonymous. Again, whether you're against or for the tactics. And I'm interested in how the lulls, which I think always existed to some degree within hacking, it was maybe not called that, but there, of course, is a culture of pranking, which is more or less playful, that has existed. I'm interested in why that kind of erupted in the last 5 or 6 years. And then I'm also very, very interested and focused in on what marks forms of hacker politics as distinct from other forms of digital activism. I don't necessarily consider them worlds apart. This is not a different universe. But it is an interesting galaxy of sorts, and a very complicated galaxy with many different planets, which are in a sort of conversational orbit together. And yet, I like the differences. I'm very much into the differences between different hacker groups as much as I am interested in the similarities.
Do you see a continuity between all those various forms of political acting in the hacker scene or out of the hacker scene? When also you look at all these variations over time, is there some constant element to it, some basic ideology that stays stable?
mean, it's definitely the case that you do see some touchstones that come up over and over again, which are things like free speech and censorship and privacy, which, you know, and this is something I've argued also, which is not rocket science, but these commitments are not hackers alone. They're not the only ones who embrace these civil liberties, but they have a very long life in many liberal democracies.
I think you called them libertarian.
Libertarian, and sometimes it's on a spectrum from a communitarian liberalism to a more individual libertarianism. Because hacking is so diverse, it takes those many multiple forms. And also things like free speech are elastic enough that what that means and the proper channels by which to bring them into being are open for debate. And that's what hackers are great at. It's like, let's talk about what that means. So they're not completely alone in that regard. They're really connected to broader social currents. And yet, what does mark them as different is that they often bring these values into being through technological channels. They embed their technology with these values. And not everyone can do that. You know, that's a form of technological literacy that is still quite contained. And it is one of the reasons why I think hackers draw some suspicion, because they do have a certain form of power that many other political actors do not have and do not hold. And that's what marks them as different from the many other different types of political actors that exist.
I think this fact is the reason why hacktivism is seen by many people now as the more effective form of protest, because there is no standardized way from politicians to deal with it so far. And when we come back to the analysis of Anonymous, when you go through the camp here and talk with various people, you will get a whole range of opinions about Anonymous, Antisec, Lulsec, even Telecomics, who are here at the camp, and they range usually from they are our heroes to these are either total bastards or some young script kiddies without any clue of what they're really doing. And I was wondering, why do you think there is so much curiosity and no clear opinion about what the nature of Anonymous is, even within the hacker culture?
Absolutely. Something like free software, for example. There's obviously, I've met some hackers who really are not into free software and open source, but I would say they're kind of sometimes a minority, or they've got very specific reasons. A lot of hackers are like, cool, open source Linux. I can stand behind that even if I maybe use an Apple or something. Now, as you noted, Anonymous reactions are all over the map. Love, hate, just couldn't care less, a more kind of ambivalent stance. Why is that? Well, I think it's in part reflects what Anonymous is, which is really not a stable group who has a position, but a name that different individuals and groups of people have taken to enact very different types of politics. So it's not surprising that the reactions are going to be all over the map, because Anonymous themselves tactically are all over the map. They themselves have engaged in so many different types of political actions, from, I think, some of the best organized street protests when it came to some of the early protests against the Church of Scientology. They're still very sophisticated, but they're just a little bit smaller, to very disruptive black bloc like tactics with Lulsec, and then the anti-sec operation within Anonymous, to taking some of the work of Telecomics and also offering aid on the ground in Tunisia and Egypt and doing kind of human rights activism, to these huge, massive blockades. I mean, I've just talked about four very different types of tactics, right? But that's the interesting thing about Anonymous, is while there's all these different tactics and different networks and nodes, and it's not a unitary thing, we often talk about it in a kind of singular way, anonymous, because it's a little bit like pornography, which is really hard to define, but you know it when you see it. Anonymous has a very standard iconography, and it also just comes with certain types of markers that make it feel and look like anonymous, right? And hence, there's this kind of contradiction within anonymous. It's singular and it's plural at the same time, which is one of the reasons why you have so many different types of reactions.
Mm-hmm. And you really think that there is this continuity to anonymous in all its various forms, also in the national entities which evolved, like Anonymous Germany, Anonymous Austria, and stuff like that?
You know, that's, I think I wouldn't be willing to come down very hard on anything right now, because in all honesty, I'm most familiar only with two networks, the Chanology kind of anti-Scientology network, and then Anonops. And there have been some other, and there are still some other kind of active nodes, such as The Plan, which is a forum. There's another server, which has recently been home to some big operations in Latin America. And then there are big anonymous kind of contingents in like Germany and the Netherlands. And I'm not so familiar with different cultural factors at play, though I'm sure that they exist. And obviously there are differences, and I've seen people in Chanology sometimes be very, very critical of Anonops, for instance, right? Because they no longer really use illegal tactics. And yet somehow the look and feel, to borrow something from copyright law, there is a consistency so far. Whether that will stay in place over time, I'm not so sure. I'm not always so good at prediction.
It's quite tempting to start seeing Anonymous as a kind of meme. I would like to know your opinion about memetics and how it works as a scientific concept, because I had my problems with it. But we're running out of time already, and I only was wondering if you would agree that this function of a Vental, the symbol, which also is part of the famous dialogue in the film, V Like Vendetta, which originates the Guy Fawkes masks after the comic did, and kind of is the often featured film and scene when it comes to anonymous statements. And is this universal idea of political possibilities of we as a collective can unite and we will be stronger than the conservative political powers? This is, for me at least, the meme I can see constantly with all those emergencies, whether they may be in North Africa, Europe, Asia, or America.
Right. I mean, I too have my problems with the use of the term meme sometimes, because it is often put in biological or evolutionary terms, and that's not what I think is interesting about internet memes. What I think is interesting about internet memes is how they are images, catchphrases, an idea that do have a propensity to travel very promiscuously, quickly, and remain consistent and change at once, right? So lolcats, whether it's just the idea of a lolcat or genres within there, like basement cat or ceiling cat, there's a consistency, right, to them, and yet you create new scenarios. And in that way, anonymous is meme-like, absolutely.
I mean, you mentioned earlier the politics of, what do you call it, name facts, that anonymous, if you start stand out as a person, as a spokesperson, then you're usually banned from the collective. How is this with you? I mean, you are in a very special situation where you are partly involved, partly observing, and speaking out publicly about, and maybe sometimes even for anonymous. How do you see yourself in this continuum?
Absolutely. It's a difficult position to occupy, and it's caused me a lot of internal anxiety at times, because I am very public in the news, in the media, about anonymous. And hence I kind of deviate from their ruling ethic or norm. But I would say that I think that some, probably not all, do appreciate that someone who has spent a lot of time is able to do some kind of translation work, which is in what way, in what I have often done. I also try to do a few things a little differently. I remember one show on NPR I did where I said, look, I'll do this, but I want to quote anonymous from some of their documents. This is about also giving a window into their world, which I think is really, really important to do, and I think that's appreciated. In terms of my own stance towards anonymous, obviously, like much anthropological work, there is a certain degree of empathy and understanding. But I do think that there are ways in which I can still be critical about, let's just say, some of the events that Anonymous has been party to, all the while also trying to give a window into what's positive and what's problematic from, let's just say, an activist perspective. And I think it's important to talk about that. So, for example, with a 2010 denial of service attacks and campaign, you know, this is now talking as a more, from a more personal perspective. I think DDoS campaigns can be effective if used infrequently. Once they're overabused, they don't have power. And I do think that the December 2010 one was so kind of amazing because it just attracted so many participants and really had this moment of just creating a huge splash. And I really did see people talking about it in terms of political motivations, and they were doing it conscientiously and consciously. Now, I'm also very well aware of the critique, which I also share, which is that a lot of people probably jumped on board without knowing the risks involved. And I think also talking to some Anons, they themselves were concerned as to what was going on. Many had said, we had no idea that we would get so many participants, right? And so that kind of critical perspective, I think, is key to put on the table. You can't just be like, yay, DDoS, awesome. You have to say, well, what was powerful about that moment and what was problematic about it? And I do think that I'm in a position where I can talk about that. But obviously, there's some elements that do compel me, and not always in ways that leave me with a smile on my face, and yet compelling enough that we really have to address it, and we really have to understand it, and we really have to grapple with it. And I find it very exciting and difficult research to engage in. And that's probably one of the reasons why in the last 8 months I've been sort of glued to my computer.
Every one of us is. I find, maybe to come to an end as well, one of the most interesting critiques and comparison is between Anonymous and Telecomics. Because Telecomics, I had an interview with Tomate, Herr Urbach, yesterday night, and basically he was saying that for him, DDoS attacks is a totally destructive way of protesting. And Telecomics saw themselves, I mean, they originated their self-image as a news agency, and started being very constructive with providing uncensored internet for countries under revolution in North Africa and also most currently Syria. And they also see themselves in a totally different situation when it comes to help from the collective, because they feel left alone, and they do not even have a fraction of the number which Anonymous has when it's engaging in its quite technically low skill, low iron cannon attacks. And so I was wondering if we. Because we're also witnessing something here. I mean, Telecomics officially dissolved today during the talk, and there's definitely something happening here right now. And I was wondering if you could somehow give us a grasp of that, and if you maybe have an opinion from Anonymous ever heard about Telecomics.
You know, it's interesting because they're often paired together, and there's at least one, maybe more, who participate in both domains, and they're a nice pairing because of the contrast at some level, even though definitely some work within Anonymous looks a lot like Telecomics, in part because it's also used the work of Telecomics. And I think one thing I will say is that you do want a diverse political ecology so that people can understand what the benefits and downsides of different political actions and tactics are. And one nice thing about talking about Telecomics and Anonymous together, and then also throwing in other groups such as radical tech organizations like Rise Up and May 1st and Autistici in Italy, you know, one of the amazing things is that there's really great variability, which is nice because it gives, you know, young fledgling hackers a choice to say, ah, there's different mechanisms by which to participate politically. The other good thing, too, is that instead of sort of coming really hard on a side right now, Telecomics versus Anonymous, nonetheless, the differences do open up a greater field of debate, which is, okay, let's talk about at what moments it makes sense perhaps to have direct action in your face politics, and at what moments does it not make sense to do it. And in some ways, having two groups that are often compared together allow us to spark that debate, and I think that's one of the great things about it. What I will say, and perhaps finish with, has to do with this question of intensity and burnout, too. I think one of the reasons why these two entities have been in the news so much is because they've been engaging nonstop in some form of intervention for 8 months, and now Telecomics has dissolved today, at least for a time being. And it does point to the fact of sort of activist burnout, which I think is very real and not talked about enough. And a conversation that needs to happen. How do we sort of protect collectives from burning out when you don't have the resources to necessarily prevent that defensively?
Yes.
That's a huge and important discussion.
It is huge and it's very important. And we've seen with Telecomics, definitely won't sacrifice too much. And sadly enough, we are running out of time. And I have to end this wonderful conversation, Gabriella, but I totally thank you for being here at camp and for sharing this hour with us. This will be available on Talking Anthropology very soon. And yeah, my last question for you is, on which ISC channel can one find you?
Oh. Well, I'm not going to give away all of them, but I'm on Freenode. I am also on the Anonops IRC channels. Can often be found on the Reporter channel. I'm also on AnonNet, which is the kind of Chinology IRC network. I think those are good enough for now.
Okay. And Biela Coleman on Twitter. Okay, thank you for this interview, and I'm handing now straight over to Activism Hour with Walter van der Hulst and a wonderful bunch of guests, as I see.
Please dial *611 for assistance.